It's Pat, PATT, Darien, DERIEN, Democratic National Committee woman from Mississippi, March 25th, 1974.
What is the basic conflict? I mean, I understand the basic conflict between the loyalists and the regulars, but what's the basic points of contention?
Well, the real problem is not so much the points of contention anymore. You know, I think that the regulars are resigned to the fact that they are indeed going to have to accommodate black people, and that they've got to have a different kind of a party. But the real problem is the governor, and he's inexperienced politically. He is inept politically. And he doesn't know how to negotiate. He was a prosecuting attorney before he was magically made governor by Delos Walker in a fluke that I'm sure took both of their breaths away. And he just plain doesn't know how to do it. Now there are some old die-hard regulars who had significant power in Mississippi politically, and who still have it, and maybe had it for 20 years. And there are a small number of those who just absolutely cannot make an accommodation to the change. However, their number is small.
Where does Senator Eastland fit into all of this?
Can I go back, Jeff? You say it can't be done by the governor. Can it be done by anybody in this state, or can it be done by somebody outside the state?
It can be done by Eastland. It could be done by Stennis. It could be done by William Winter. It could be done by the Executive Committee of the Regulars. It could be done by a group of legislators. It could be done by anybody with any guts, and that's the whole problem that they have. It's been the whole problem of leadership in this state. Lack of guts and lack of brains. And thank you. I will bring you.
Let me ask you something else, just so we'll understand. What is your background with the loyalists in Mississippi politics? Are you a native of Mississippi?
No, I came here in 1959, and got started really in the public school movement to keep the schools open and to keep white kids in.
So you came here from where?
Well, we had been in, my husband's a professor at the medical school. And when he finished his residency, we went to Ohio, and we lived there about 2 years. And that's the place we came from, to this place. But I'm really from Virginia, from Danville. She knew the name of it. She's my 16-year-old experiment. Anyway, I said no, and I have to trust her, right? Anyhow, I got started in the public school movement and then sort of slipped over into the civil rights movement, you know, as an extension of that. And then politics was kind of an extension of that, and in 65, when the YDs were getting put together on a biracial basis by Harding and by Spencer Oliver, by those people who did that. They asked me to be the national committee woman for the YDs, but it was the second or the third summer of the Mississippians for Public Education, and there were so few of us working in that that we had decided that we wouldn't do anything but that until, you know, we had enough people who were willing to work on it. So I didn't do it. And but then I kind of got hooked into that sort of group of people who were working politically. And then in 68, I met a number of times with those groups of people, and the decision was made to try to participate in the regulars process and see if we could get anywhere. Then the Hughes Commission guidelines had come down, but they had never, ever responded to them. None of them, the National Committee members, the governor, none of those leaders ever sent back the minimal little thing that was required. And as it happened, they didn't open the door much. They made Charles Evers a delegate, I think, and one or two total.
Now, what was the basic requirement of that Hughes Commission?
There were six elements in the Hughes thing. And in essence, it was that anybody who wanted to be a Democrat could be a Democrat and participate in it, and that you had to assure them that your party was open to all people. And the requirement was that you would send a letter stating that your party was willing to do that. That was all. It was really very little. Now, I have a copy. Oh, gosh, I've got so many documents. I know you don't want to get bogged down in those. However, in the new delegate selection guidelines, have you seen those? Anyway, they are incorporated, those Hughes things are incorporated again, updated a little bit to give recognition to ethnic groups, and says more about sex, I think, and that kind of thing. But in essence, they're the same, and they're the keystone of the reforms in the Democratic Party. So anyway, then we had this coalition, and it was kind of funny. It was mostly made up of organizations, you know, the FDP and the NAACP were the main components of it. And then there were a million subdivisions, beauticians, undertakers, teachers, you know, every kind of black organization that had ever existed. And the AFL-CIO was in it in a marginal public way, and in a very strong undercover kind of way. But I didn't represent any of those groups, and I'd worked hard, and I wanted to be on the executive committee. And Aaron and Hodding and another man and I sat at a table one day where I said that, you know, I expected to have a vote in the decision making. Aaron, who is very organizational, there's no way I can make that sentence come out right, he is oriented to organizational representation, and said that he was sorry, but, you know, I'd have to belong to some group. So we had a terrible squabble about it. I had never known him very well until 68. I had worked with Charles Evers since he came back to the state, but I didn't know Aaron very well, and there's always just a little bit of rivalry between them, although they were very close at the same time. But anyway, Hodding said he'd take me as a YD, and that made me angry, so we had a great to-do, and finally everybody lost and everybody won, in that Aaron had it fixed in his mind that I was on as a YD, and I had it fixed in my mind that I was on as myself. And since it finally boiled down to my being the one that wrote the list of who was, my name just was there alone. But it was kind of interesting because they were not much accustomed to working with women.
This was what year?
That was 68. Then we went to Chicago for the Credentials Committee here, and we won, and won the whole thing. And at some point, at the state convention, I was elected National Committee Woman in 68. And so that's kind of how I got into it.
Okay, now in 72, Waller wanted to let the loyalists have one-third representation. Is that, am I basically correct?
Well, he made several offers. One was 60-40. But what happened was Before he started making any offers, anything more than saying what it was that he wanted, we set up a negotiating team, and they set up a negotiating team. And we met down in the Heidelberg Hotel. And it turned out that their negotiating team had never talked before. You know, they had been appointed, and they had come to this meeting, but they had not made any kind of plans about what they would do, what they would say. They seemed to feel that their presence at the negotiating table was what they had to give, and that that was indeed a thing of great value. And we had met and fought and struggled for hours and hours, oh, endless meetings, probably 60 hours of meetings before we went in there. So we knew what we wanted and what we were willing to throw away in trade. And it was really incredible, because they stated that they would like to have half the delegation. And that was all. So we sat there for a couple of hours in the smoky old room, and nothing came of it. They asked us for a list of the things that we were wanting to discuss. So we gave it to them, and we had taken a, at the very beginning, they were very nervous about meeting with us. And we agreed at the very beginning, in a very solemn kind of way, that we would not discuss what we talked about, or any negotiating points with the press or with anybody else. That it would really be an off-the-record, open kind of discussion. So, somewhere in there, the governor sent a young legislator out to see me in the middle of the night. And he said that if we would give them half the delegation, the governor would go with us to Miami. And I explained to him that that might really mean a lot to them, but it just didn't mean a damn thing to us. And I was not going to negotiate unilaterally. It's been one of the problems from the very beginning, particularly with Waller and his group of people, is that they absolutely do not want to deal with any black people. And they'd rather not deal with any of us in the state. When the call to the 72 convention came, Waller and a couple of his people went to Washington, registered in a hotel under an assumed name, called the DNC, refused to go over there. Bill Welch went to the hotel to see him, and what they wanted was for Larry O'Brien to write to Aaron and ask him to send the call to the convention back to the DNC so that the DNC could send it to Waller. Now, that is not realistic thinking, and it's not bright, and it makes you cautious about trying to do any kind of dealings with a person of that type. So anyway, I sent that young fellow along the way. And then I can't remember if we met again before the regulars convention. And I don't, maybe we did one. They've also missed their dinner. This is sort of... was that we may have tried one other time. We did try twice, but I can't remember what it was before the convention or not. Anyway, we were thunderstruck when Waller got up on the platform and read off our list of negotiating points. And really, that's what they were, you know, complete with throwaways, as absolute demands, saying that they were not going to be blackmailed by this kind of stuff. And, we were almost all there, sitting in the back. And then he said that what he was going to do, let's see, he would give us 2 weeks, I think, to give them half of the seats. And if we didn't do it in that time, he would go to federal court. And then he would go to the Credentials Committee. And then he would go to the full convention. Well, it just shows you what a boob he was, even if he's going to do it that way. If he's trying to gain any points with the National Committee or the National Party, he would say he was going to the Credentials Committee. I mean, anybody would know that. But indeed, he went to federal court. We were in court 2 weeks. And the case got enormously complicated for several reasons. One is that Chuck Morgan was our lawyer. And one issue after another reveals itself so that they never really knew what hit them. It was lovely, really. Anyway, they didn't get to go, even though they had a last-minute appeal to a three-judge panel in the Fifth Circuit. And then they went to the Credentials Committee. Waller went there and argued the case, and we won a unanimous decision, including the Wallace people. I mean, it was just unbelievable. And somewhere in the midst of that, maybe during the bomb scare, or maybe just when we got started, we all rushed up to a hotel room with Waller and two of his henchmen standing around. And that was the first time he came up with anything besides half the delegation. And McNair, that man who used to be governor of South Carolina, came down to see what he could do during the trial. He talked to Waller. Then he came down to see us. By then, we had a week of the trial in Jackson, and the second week was down on the coast. So he came down to the coast, and he said, I explained to Governor Waller that all he has to do is what I did in South Carolina. I just took the chief honcho of the NAACP and made him our legal counsel and gave him a little praise, and he said all the rest of them fell in line. You know, it just really kind of takes your breath away. The assumption that because you are white and Southern, that's the way I was really absolutely astonished. But anyhow, McNair failed also. He failed with Waller and he failed with us. He was a dead loss. I talked to Strauss on the phone 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he said, now we want to get that thing straightened out down there. And I agreed piously that indeed we did. And he said he thought he'd send Bob McNair down, since the Democratic Party has no sense of its past. You know, that was under Larry O'Brien, and so now we have Strauss, we start all over again. But anyway, I explained that maybe McNair was not the ideal person to come, and he didn't understand it at all. But I ployed with Wendell Ford, who is also not my idea of the right person to come, but I thought it would confuse Wendell Ford so that he wouldn't think of coming if I wanted him. So, you know, it's just a matter of sort of dancing around on the top of all these other extraneous matters. So anyway, he lost in the Credentials Committee, and since not one living being voted for the regulars, they didn't have enough for a minority report to the National Convention. And I suppose by then felt that, you know, there was no hope. But even now, they will, well, when there was the telethon back in the summer or the fall, or, you know, whenever that thing was, Waller called up and I think maybe somebody appeared in Washington with a check for $15,000 for the DNC to use as their donation. And I must say, for Strauss, he wouldn't touch it. He called me right up and told me they had offered it and he hadn't taken it. So we're on pretty safe ground as far as that goes, but it's absolutely absurd to have a political party like this. We have 23% of the vote, and if we lived in Arizona where everybody's a Republican, you know, that would be what you go with. But it's not in the interest of the people here to be Republicans, and most of them aren't. And we need to get the party together. But it's certainly teaching me patience. It takes a very long time to do things like this. But by 76, we'll have it. One, we'll have a new governor. And unless we get some Neanderthal like A.F. Summer, the Attorney General, or Jim Buck Ross, the man who's head of the Department of Agriculture now, we'll have it worked out, and it'll be fair.
And then what will it be? What will the state of the Democratic Party in Mississippi be at then?
Well, it'll be interesting, because one of the real problems is that there's not much confidence on the part of either segment in the other group. you know, we have to have some guarantees. It was one of the things Waller didn't understand about trying to negotiate at the very last minute before the Credentials Committee. You know, he said 60-40, and then there were arrangements about the National Committee members and the chair and the vice chair and all that kind of thing. But really not very much, all very sketchy. And when you're doing a negotiation of a merger of two organizations with the kinds of feelings that exist between these two, you have to be very careful. You have to build in guarantees. And it's not the kind of thing you do like plea bargaining at the door to the courtroom. You know, it's just not the same thing. And he was never ever able to grasp that concept that this was something different. But we'd have to have a careful agreement, a carefully drawn agreement.
Are you saying, though, that Waller, during all this time, was negotiating as a prosecutor,
oh, yes,
holding all the cards?
Right.
Sort of thing?
That's his mentality. One of his own people told me that you just had to understand he had the prosecutor's mentality. And that may be what it is. I have...
But he personally is doing this. I mean, it's not some henchman or somebody else that's involved. He's personally leading all the negotiations and all the efforts or whatever.
Well, he was at that time. Now he pretends that he doesn't know anything about it. In fact, I called him up. Somebody told me that they had filed a delegate selection plan for the 74 midterm conference. So I called him up and said, please send me a copy of your delegate selection plan. And he said, well, listen, I don't know if I can do that. He said, I don't know if we're letting that out. I'm not on the executive committee. I'd have to ask them. I said, nonsense. It's the Democratic Party. You have to make it public. You have to show it to me. To put it out to the press. And he said, well, I guess I could send you one. I said, no, you can give one to any Democrat who wants one. That's the way it goes. So he sent it. And it was just awful. I was really embarrassed for him. I could have filed a better reform than that. And so, you know, in fact, they didn't even understand. See, they just can't seem to understand. The point of the thing is that now that they are the challengers, so instead of filing a challenge to ours, they filed their own as though they was the Democratic Party. You know, I tell you, it's a matter of brains and courage.
How do you think it's going to end up being resolved?
It's going to be resolved. One, he won't be the governor anymore, and he won't be the problem. And it might even be resolved before he stops being the governor.
Where does Eastland fit into all of this?
Eastland? Well, Eastland's really interesting because Waller's his guy, has been from the very beginning. But Eastland has a very limited sphere of interest. And so he counts on Waller to do what he tells him to do in the areas that are of concern to him. And the rest of the time, he just leaves him sort of flopping around. And I think that he's just beginning to realize the extent of his disability. Although I told him, I went to see him one time and told him that it was really not fair to Waller to, you know, tell him what to do when it was in his interest and then let him just dig himself deeper and deeper, and that he ought to take him off somewhere and teach him some politics. It was really awful for him. It was embarrassing for Waller, and it's embarrassing for the state. And he laughed and chewed his cigar. Said he was going to take a trip with him to California, and that was just at the time when the Republicans were getting ready to meet out there. So we laughed gaily about that. But Eastland, I hear, has put the word out that he wants this thing solved. And, you know, we're beginning to talk around to the next round of power people.
Well, hasn't Waller recently called himself a national Democrat?
Oh.
He's been calling himself a national Democrat.
Hmm?
I say he's been calling himself a national Democrat.
Well, sometimes he says he is, and sometimes he says he's a Mississippi Democrat. he made a big to-do about saying who he was going to vote for and put it off for about 3 weeks and finally was on his way to the airport to take a trip to South America. And some reporters got him and said, "Governor, you promised us you'd tell." He said, well, he changed his mind. He didn't think he would. And so, you know, he never declared for McGovern, never said he voted for McGovern. Went down when one of those Nixon children appeared on the coast at a Republican rally during the campaign and explained to people how they could split the ticket. So it isn't, you know. He just doesn't know what he's doing. It's a pity to spend so much time talking about him, except I guess he's in the grand tradition of dopes running things in the South. You know, second raters left at home trying to be statesmen. It's very perplexing and distressing. And he's a sweet fellow, you know, very hearty and warm and friendly. Wants to be the most loved governor in the history of the state and wouldn't hurt anybody. Just in over his head.
But Eastland wants it solved, you say?
Sure he does. You know that's an embarrassment to him. It'll be solved.
Was Eastland interested in building a strong Democratic Party in Mississippi?
Well, as I say, his interests are limited, and I'm not convinced that that's one of them. I think his interests are mostly personal. And how old is he? He's not old enough. I keep thinking he's a lot older than he is, so I suppose he'd go again. He'd probably be close to 70 next time around. And he didn't like being challenged by Gil Carmichael, the Republican. And if Nixon had given him the nod, he would be our United States Senator now. I think Eastland was really shaken by the percentage of the vote that Carmichael got. So,
you think Nixon made a difference in that?
Oh, made the whole difference. If it hadn't been for Nixon, Eastland would not be up there now. Did you see the evening news? Eastland and Stennis had breakfast with Nixon this morning.
Yeah.
He's really counting his votes. Stennis is
15 years ago, probably. Was 15 years ago, it's 1959.
Well, yes, I suppose. Really, I do think that practically everything you do out of your house turns out to be political. So that's right.
What major changes have you seen in the state in that time?
Oh God, they've been phenomenal. Of course, the most dramatic one is the change in having black people able to vote. That really has made an enormous difference. The Voting Rights Act and the presence of civil rights lawyers here for 14 years have made all the difference. And I give them equal standing to, I think, the presence of those lawyers suing and suing and suing and suing.
Any particular lawyers?
Sure, the Lawyers Committee for, what is it, the LCDC, you know, which is defunct now. I can't think of it now. How awful. Anyway, Armand Durkin, Al Bronstein, Bruce Rogo in the early 60s. Then the Lawyers Committee, which is Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. George Taylor, who's gone to Alabama now. Frank Parker, who's still here. That whole crew of them. Of course, Mel Leventhal with the Ink Fund, who's really made such strides in school desegregation. It's unbelievable. And he's the one that got the Shaw case, which is the equalization of facilities in the black part of the community. You know, I mean, really, it's unbelievable what they've done. Chuck Morgan with his one man, one vote and jury things. You know, he worked out of Atlanta, but those cases affected us too. You just can never calculate what a difference it's made in the whole life of the place, and particularly in the political life. And Marion Wright, when she was here, now Marion Wright Edelman. So there's all of that, and it's one of those cataclysmic events that, black people voting, that you still, years after the actual fact of, are reaping results from. I think that, when we first moved here, no black person was safe walking on the street. Anywhere in this state, not in this town or any other place. The system of justice simply did not apply to black people. I expect that there's not one black person I know in this state who hasn't at some time been abused by police or by white people with the acquiescence of the police. And when you look back from this day to the way it was when you moved here, I can hardly believe that anybody stood it, that the black people put up with it, or that the white community put up with it. It's just absolutely astonishing to me when I think of the way we lived. Charles Evers used to call me up and use a code name on the telephone. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So it's not that everything's better. We still have terrible problems of poverty. We have terrible jails. The penitentiary is a nightmare. Black people are still abused from time to time in various ways. But that absolute iron control is gone. And it just makes an enormous difference.
Did you ever have any threats made against you?
Almost certainly, but it was of no consequence. I mean, it was sort of scary at the time. But when you consider the actual things that happened to other people, black people particularly, it was...
Why did you decide to come to Mississippi anyway?
Well, it's very funny. I was engaged to a man from Mississippi, and I decided that I absolutely could not live in this place. Having grown up in elegant uptown Virginia, I had a very low opinion of Mississippi. And so I bid him a fond farewell and explained that I couldn't live here. And then I married this man from New York at the University of Virginia. And when we were in Ohio, a classmate of his asked him to come down and look at this job at this medical school, a second man in the Department of Orthopedics. And he came down and he looked at it. He said it was a brand new medical school and it would be fun, but he was not going to be second man anyway. And in about 4 months, the first man left and they offered him a job as head of the department. And he said he'd like to come. And that people didn't look as bad as the pictures of Mississippi in the 30s had said, and we got beginning, and so I was. And that's how it came about.
Did you have any regrets after you got here?
No, it was such a revelation. I mean, I regretted the way the place was. I was stunned and horrified and also ashamed of myself, because it finally dawned on me that things were probably much like this in the place that I had grown up, and that I had really not been aware of the extent of it. And I was far away from all of my relatives, so I was free to do as I pleased. And I really couldn't live anywhere else. I mean, I could go somewhere else for a while, but this is the place I would prefer to leave. Problems are enormous, but they're easy to identify. Only 2 million people live here, so it's not an unmanageable kind of thing like Manhattan. And the climate's great. I like a lot of humidity, and I like a lot of hot air and growing things and soft ground to walk on. And And it's an interesting place. And so much needs to be done.
Where do you see the Democratic Party in Mississippi after 1976?
Well, the ideal thing, I think, would be to try to do it as though it were just a plain political party, and that there was something to be gained from having a well-organized state party, that you would have an executive, you would have an office, you would have a system of fundraising, and that, you see, one of the things I discovered, oh, I didn't discover it alone, but which was a great surprise to me, was when the Voting Rights Act was passed, there was a lot of talk everywhere about the newly enfranchised black voter, politically naive and inexperienced. And there's still a lot of talk about that, as a matter of fact, but what was quickly evident is that the white voter in Mississippi was in exactly the same boat. There was no political party here. There was, you know, what was called a political party. It was run by a very small handful of men. And the only political exercise that citizens got, really, was going out and voting, which is really, you know, not all of it. There's a lot more to it than that. So the state is just ripe for a good organizer. And you might very well begin to move away from the one issue, race, into other issues that are pressing.
Well, we've been told that race really was not a real issue in the governor's race last time.
No, it wasn't.
Well, do you see a populist coalition forming? I mean, things heading
well,
in that direction?
Well, I'm very leery of those kinds of labels. But what I would hope would be some sort of issue-oriented thing which would amount to it. It's been very interesting, Common Cause in this state. See, I think Common Cause is a much bigger threat to political parties everywhere than people are considering. But they attract an enormous number of people, and in Mississippi, a surprising type person. You know, a woman came over from Jones County. That's Laurel. That's backwoods, redneck, Klan country. And she came over because she belongs to Common Cause, and they had given her a job to do, which was to interview me. You know, not me particularly, but the person in my category. And they give their people things to do. They have meetings where they discuss things, you know, and get their opinions. And it's that concept of feeding in that these people are ready for. So I'm not sure what form it would take. I don't think it's going to be any agrarian kind of movement, but I think it would be...
I'm talking about contemporary populace, and what my definition of that is basically blacks and...
And poor whites.
And poor whites, or working class whites, let's say... George Wallace.
Everybody else lives here.
Right.
I mean, you know.
I mean, George Wallace.
98% of the people make under $10,000 a year in this state.
Well, no, the people who voted for George Wallace in '68 forming a coalition with blacks, or a segment of that.
Well, I don't think it would be as bald a thing as that.
I don't mean all of them. Then you'd have the whole state.
Right. Except for the 42 Republicans. The reason that I just sort of hesitate to say yes, because I don't think it will be struck along those lines, you know, that we are amalgamating these kinds of people. But with proper organization, it would come about that their interests would be in common. However, you know, it takes time and planning, and my experience is that very few people are willing to plan, that they sort of operate out of the hip pocket according to the expedient necessity. I think that it's ready. I think people would like it. I think it would be interesting. I think it's possible. What happens now in these last few elections has been discouraging and disarming to some of the regulars and has made them a little more open about putting the party together and trying to have a party organization. And that is that each politician in this state has a box of names, and they are his names. They are his people who give him money and lend him machines and automobiles and do his political work with him. Okay, in the past, those supporters had to do it twice, the first primary and the second primary. And they were sufficient. But now there's a Republican challenge almost everywhere, you know. And they have to do it all over again. While the Republicans have been very, very cautious not to have a lot of primaries, so that they save everything for the one shot. Their money, their organization, their energy. And Ellis Bodron, who's a longtime state senator and a very powerful one, learned that lesson in the last congressional race when he lost to Thad Cochran, the Republican. There was no reason to believe that Ellis Bodron would lose to this upstart kid that nobody ever heard of. But what happened was he was in a really bloody primary with a young legislator who would have been wonderful. And he spent all his money. And his people put all their money in. They got to the general election, he didn't have anything to go on. And if you had a political organization, then your organization would take over after your primary victory. So you wouldn't have to continue to bleed the people that you already used up, in essence. You know, you'd have something more. So it's just a logical thing to do. Of course, an awful lot depends on Wallace. Everything here, and maybe in the whole Democratic Party, is contingent upon Wallace. Not upon his actions, but upon the actions of the Democratic Party to him. Right now, I think they're pandering to him. They want those votes he's got so badly that they'll go down there and bow and scrape to him in Alabama. And I think he's taking him for a ride. That he's either going to make constant demands that they will not honorably be able to meet, or else he's going to leave them flat and say, I've tried for 4 years to work with these people, and he's going to roll out all his defeats in the National Committee meeting and all the bad things that all the Democrats have done. And he's going to say, all you people come with me, and he will have picked up some more. But I see the people in Michigan. Look at Jim O'Hara and his stand on busing. He's done a complete about face. I think he'd lead a parade across the country against busing if anybody would start one. That's Michigan. Yeah. Mm. So a lot depends on him. And Charles Evers goes running over there to pat him on his head. And Johnny Ford in Tuscaloosa. Jay Cooper. Bad business. He's a bad man.
You think Wallace has changed?
Heavens no. He's never said he's changed. He maintains that he always believed in freedom and justice. He hasn't known what before. I haven't been able to see that from the very beginning. He has never once repudiated anything he did. And he did a lot of bad stuff. And as a result of that leadership, a lot of people are dead. And I know that Ted Kennedy and a lot of those would like to pretend that this is a new day and this is a new man. But really, while it's quite an exaggeration, to suppose that it were Hitler 15 years later, and you would say to the Jewish community, well, look, you know, it was 15 years ago, and he didn't really mean that. You know, that's really kind of the way I feel about it. I think a lot of black people feel that. Well, I do not say that he was Hitler or equating with Hitler. It's the same principle operating as far as I'm concerned. Interesting to see.
We have heard from some people who, that they think that Wallace has changed.
Oh, I know. We have heard that too. Well, change from what?
Well,
standing demagogue to a sitting demagogue.
No, they maintained that Wallace, because of being shot and the experience he's resulted since that time, has become a more compassionate person.
I'm sure that's what people would like to believe. One would hope that something of that magnitude would have some effect, but I don't see any evidence of it. Kind of seemed to me. What's that? Colson, you know? He was saved. Took Jesus as his personal savior, and he just stood right up and said so. I haven't seen Wallace say anything like that.
Have you noticed any change in perceptions among your colleagues on the committee towards Mississippi? You run it when you talk to people around the country about it, I'm sure you know about Mississippi, that the whole set of stereotypes and perceptions. Has that changed at all?
Well, of course,
are you
the National Committee has changed in that it got so big, so there are lots of new people.